Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't gonna be in there. But 51% of your prisoners will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Black won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control buildings and industry, and put that pools in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 or 13 times for a lead. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations, who got the money? That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control, and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor, and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor, that is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries, and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk only control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisoners in the United States are black people. You only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March for what? Who cares? Marching, they never changed anything.
I got in a huge tax situation in 2008 because my divorce was in 2005, and my accountant had gotten in cahoots, and next thing you know, my accountant died, and a girl that worked for him called my lawyer and said, "We have a problem." She had found on the floor all my tax forms for 7 years signed and with the checks stapled to them. So I'm thinking, I done signed and I done stapled the checks. Well, they were cashing the checks, keeping the money, and not turning in the tax form. They took the money out of the account that matched the exact, because I wasn't watching it.
So like, you could just see $100,000
deducted.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking it's the check. Little did I know, it was some people taking the money out.
For 7 years?
For 7 years.
How much money did that?
I ended up owing $22
million. Wow.
$22 million with the penalties. So now, wow. Listen to me, man. Me and my wife in 2008, I get the call. And the way I found out was, my lawyer called me and said, "Hey, man, we got a problem. You haven't paid taxes in 7 years. I said, "Man, what are you talking about? I paid taxes. I've been writing the checks and all this here." "Oh, man." He said, "This woman found your taxes in your accountant's office on the floor. Every packed check I had written, and every was stapled together for 7 years, quarterly taxes, all of it. So he said, man, that's tax evasion. You can go to prison. And I said, what are we going to do? So he said, hold on, man, let me get some lawyers. So he called up some tax accountants out of Chicago. These boys was the best. And they sat me down and they said, man, we got a major problem. He said, I got a friend working at the IRS. Let me take the first year. We took the first year and we sent it in. And he said, man, well, this is an old tax return. He said, man, we got a problem. He got more, but he didn't know it. And so we need a tax payment plan. So the tax payment plan was so astronomical that it was no way I could pay this. So the deal was, if you miss one payment, we come and seize all your assets and you go into jail. That was the deal. So the way I found out I was in real bad trouble was my accountants, my former manager, lawyer, got on a conference call to discuss it. But they sent out an email with the conference call number to my assistant. But it wasn't supposed to go to me. She inadvertently gave it to me. I wasn't even supposed to be on the call. So when I logged in, they were already talking, and I just didn't announce myself. And I heard them say, nobody can live under this amount of stress. There's no way he can pay the back taxes, pay his current taxes, and his living expenses. And I heard a guy on the phone say, what are we going to do when he goes to jail? And I hung the phone up. I went upstairs. I said, Marjorie, Dawson, I said, Marjorie, we got a problem. When I explained it to her, Marjorie started crying. She sat down and cried. My wife cried for 2 straight days. She said, Steve, what you going to do? I said, I'm going to go to work. I took every comedy gig in this country. I signed every contract. I went to work, man. I worked every single Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. I went to every venue, the Verizon, Staples Center, MCI, Phillips. I sold out the Fox. I went everywhere. I stayed on the radio, man. I'm coming, sold out. I never missed a payment. And for 4 years in a row, I was sending $650,000 a month to the government. Plus, I had to pay my current taxes. I couldn't get behind on nothing. And I was living. So I was credit cards, running them up, paying them off. And finally, man, in 2012, I sold 49% of my radio company to iHeart. I got a check, man. I got me a check. And then, so I paid the government completely off to zero. And that was the first time, man, I could breathe. And then the pay-per-view, I said, let me get out of stand-up, because my wife said, Steve, you're finna be a major TV star. You're going to have to stop telling the jokes you're telling, because you're going to ruin your career. Because she saw the political correctness turning. And so she said, Steve, you can stop if you want to. I said, baby, I can't ever stop telling jokes. It's who I am. She said, well, okay, but you got to watch what you say. And all of my TV shows are sponsor-driven. The radio is sponsorship-driven. I said, man, let me get out of this, because I need time to go do more TV. And so I did one last comedy show, but I did it on pay-per-view. And little did I know, for $8, you could watch my last show. I had no idea how many people was going to tune in for that. I made a lot of money. It was the biggest single paycheck I ever made. And next thing you know, I was back. Now, learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This God done put some people around me. Show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said, this man that went to heaven, and he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. He messed around. He saw one of them doors and had his name on it.
He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know. He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he's here. He said, nah, I want to know what's in the dough. He said, you sure you want to see what's in the dough? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you happen is, when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it, because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on Not Meant to Be Way, because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go over on Pity Way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off, because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it's on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she's been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin.
Before I get started with this video, I just want to personally thank the brother Fred Hassan Powell of the Morale Facebook page for sharing this social political cartoon, which is currently displayed in this video. I always big up brothers who are artists like him, my man Will James, Alex K. Art, Chris Miller, and others because their pictures speak volumes. They don't have to say one word because, as they say, a picture is worth a thousand words. In fact, I want y'all to take a good look at this picture, which shows a brother with his hat flipped to the back, telling the bald-headed brother that he's hungry as fuck. When the brother attempts to hand him his own fishing rod so he can get some fish on his own, he gets verbally assaulted. No, nigga, I want some fish. Fuck out of here with that coon shit. Man, if you look closer, you'll see that the brother that says he's hungry got a fresh pair of Jordans on his feet. And once again, I want to thank you, Fred, for sharing that photo because it is a perfect warm-up for what I'm getting ready to bring up next. Look, last week, I had to stop past a gas station, and when I went in, I took a quick glance over to the newsstand, and I saw the Washington Post. The first thing that caught my eye was something that you normally don't see on the cover of a newspaper, which was a few straggling pants sagging brothers sitting on a stoop of a building outside. I didn't have the time to read the paper in the gas station because I had to fly, but I checked the article online when I got home, and I was just flabbergasted. I want you all to check it out for yourself in the description box. It is the December 9th edition of the Washington Post, and the front cover story is a look back at the riots which took place in Baltimore this past April following the death of Freddie Gray. The Post took the time to interview a few of the residents and get their personal take on how things have been and has any positive change come to the streets of Baltimore after the riots. And one of the brothers that they interviewed was a young man that was out there on the streets peddling drugs from time to time, and he stated that he ended up finding out shortly after the riots that there were a few storefront apartments that were up for sale and that they were only selling for just $5,000 a piece. He then said that when he ran the idea of getting together and investing in the neighborhood past several brothers that he was out there selling drugs with on the streets, all of them told him no. And see, this goes to what brothers like myself, Sean James, and many others who are right here on YouTube have been telling y'all about this modern Negro. Okay, this Baltimore brother that was interviewed by the Washington Post had a great idea and the right frame of mind to purchase this storefront property while the price is extremely low. But the rest of the Negroes that are around him ended up dragging him into the quagmire of apathy that surrounds the Negro landscape.
Shit, dude. Yeah. Yeah. Hit you in your face. Yeah, dude. Your ass.
That bitch scared, nigga.
Oh.
Beat her motherfucking ass. She's like you, motherfucking nigga. Beat her motherfucking ass.
That nigga can't be hurting himself.
You from New State.
It's over. It's over. It's over. What I say is over. Everybody get the fuck out of here.
Man, fuck it. Let's go across the street.
Who got
them
right? Because I ain't caught it. I'll slap the fuck out of one of y'all.
Look, the main spot that this brother was looking to purchase had five rooms between both of the upstairs levels, and it just needed a little bit of furnishing. These spots could have easily been rented out to tenants or used as cheap housing by family and friends that could have worked a legitimate business out of that storefront. The Negro just don't get it, because the more legitimate storefronts, strip mall shops, apartments and tenements you own would lessen the police targeting you, because then you can do what the foreigners and white folks that own these places do, which is hire the police to work security at your properties and places of business. Why do you think they don't go upside the heads of these foreigners? Because they step to the police officers and let them know that they have work for them. These foreigners and white folks that own and run these storefronts hire the cops, and if they don't pay them with cash, they give them free merchandise and meals on the house, so they in turn look out for them. And half these cops do moonlighting security at these places even when they are on duty, because all they got to do most of the time is just drive through with a squad car or do a quick foot patrol right near the business or apartment housing units that are being rented out. This is why they don't give the Chan family or any Chinese youngster any problems when they see them in the hood by their dry cleaners. This is why they don't bother Mr. or Mrs. Akbar or any Arab kids that they see near the gas stations they own. This is why they don't mess with Miss Yee or any of her grandkids that are close to the nail salon she owns. because they take a small percentage of the proceeds and pad the local policeman's pockets. And see, your typical foolish Negro that would challenge what I just told you will say, well, see, you insinuating that we got to bribe the police for them to stop brutalizing us. But they, like most, don't know anything about capitalism. It is a game of economic musical chairs. I just gave you the analogy when I mentioned all the foreign families that own all the storefronts, strip malls, and rental properties. Who is the only one who is left standing up with no businesses or property to speak of when the music is done playing and the cops roll through the neighborhood? That's us, yapping back and forth when the music stops and they tell our loitering asses to get moving or catch a bruising. That's us, walking around with sagging pants and glow-in-the-dark fluorescent color wigs like this sister that you see right here tossing rocks during the riot last April. Now, she's throwing rocks and expressing her anger and frustration, but she has a fresh weave on top of her head, which helped pay some of the officers that broke Freddie Gray's back. So who is the sellout and coon, black folks? And think about it. If you own some of those storefronts and control the flow of unlaundered, legitimate-made currency that comes through those areas, you can do your illegal dirt all day long without that much harassment from the local authorities. You might draw attention from a few alphabet gang organizations, like the DEA, FBI, and others, but the local guys aren't going to pay that much attention because you're helping them pay bills and you're putting food in their stomach. And since I brought up the subject of illegal activity and you pants-sagging clowns love to talk about how gangster you are, why don't you do what some of the Irish, Italian, Jewish, and Polish immigrants your dumbass keeps trying to emulate did by legitimizing some of your hustles and using the same police force that chases you around the neighborhood as a shield. See, most Negroes will try to tell you that we are always at the end of a nightstick, a baton, or getting showered with bullets just because we are black. But ask yourself a question. Why aren't that many Ethiopians and West Africans getting mollywopped and punished to the extent that many so-called African Americans are in the U.S.? Remember, they're just as black and sometimes way darker than us. But why are there fewer cases of them being brutalized and killed by the police like we saw with Amadou Diallo or Abner Louima, both of which took place in New York? Why so few cases compared to us so-called Afro-Americans? It's because they're smart enough to own businesses, restaurants, furniture stores, parking lots, etc., and pay the cops to look the other way so their fellow countrymen aren't harmed in any way. That's the logical thing to do. But you can't tell this Negro from America that, because you're still living off the backwards principle and creed of entitlement, which these liberals drafted up for us long ago. Instead of assessing this situation from a global perspective and seeing that everyone else seems to be purchasing everything around us so they can live comfortable lives and keep us at a position of marginalization as opposed to putting themselves in that boat, the Negro man and woman in the U.S. will counter it by saying, see, I object because my tax dollars pay for the police not to harass me. No, they don't, you imbecile. Especially after Uncle Sam rapes their paycheck just like he rapes everybody else's. Now, your pro-whack movement pseudo-black nationalist leaders will call me a coon for telling you this, but this is something that they know firsthand. They also know that you more than likely won't view this phenomenon from all angles because you're still under the influence of the can't we all just get along flavor Kool-Aid most black folks drank after the post-civil rights movement era, thinking that all the bigotry-enhanced physical assaults and beatdowns we took during chattel slavery and Jim Crow had an exclusive cutoff date to them. Which is why every single year one of these highly publicized police brutality incidents takes place, there's some dumb Negro that says, I don't believe that in 2087 this is still happening to black people. Yeah, it is. And it's going to keep on happening in 2088 if you don't adopt a different way of thinking, dummy. Your pseudo-black nationalists won't tell you that you are mostly to blame for this continually happening because they want you to keep feeling sorry for yourself and attend more lectures and debates where they argue over whether or not a woman is God or which master teacher's philosophy is better to follow. But I'm here to tell you right now, black folks, that we don't need to attend a gazillion seminars. travel with a million other jugheads to commemorate the anniversary of a march that never led to mass black improvement, or study the teachings of some philosophical doctor with 10 degrees to find a solution to our problem. This brilliant brother from Baltimore that was interviewed in the December 9th edition of the Washington Post, who more than likely didn't even finish high school, just gave us the answer. And if you're wondering why I titled this thing Ballin' on Baltic Avenue, I did so as a way of saluting one of my grandfathers. See, long ago when I was a very little boy, he taught me how to play Monopoly. I was about 7 years old, and I was all geeked up racing around the board to buy Boardwalk and Park Place. And he said, go right on ahead. He let me do it and said, I'll just buy a Baltic, Mediterranean, Oriental, and all these other properties that you aren't even thinking about. So as the game went on, and I only owned Boardwalk, Park Place, and Pacific, I think, he had all the other properties, the railroads, the waterworks, the electric company, and a whole bunch of hotels and houses on all of them while I was looking silly. And I ended up having to sell what I owned and wait for that $200 paycheck once I passed go. Once it finally set in that I lost the game, he chuckled and told me, son, you got to own what's in the ghetto before you walk around the block. And that lesson that my grandfather Dave, rest his soul, taught me still applies to this very day. Ownership is a universal language, no matter what culture or ethnicity you come from, because it regulates the sort of relationship you're going to have with most of the people around you.
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But, man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles, the kid no one would pick, was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Four years ago, we started a microgreen farm. We started growing microgreens at home in our living room. And today we got...
What's up, guys? This is Alex Martin, and this is the Content Creator Podcast, where I stimulate your mind and show you how to market your grind. And today, we're going to stimulate your mind. I got the legend, the icon, Freeway Rick Ross. How you doing today, bro?
I'm good. How you?
I'm good, bro. Can't complain.
No doubt.
I can't lie, man. Right now, I'm like, I got the jitters, you know.
Because I see you geeked.
Yeah, I'm excited. And first, I want to say thank you. Like, you didn't have to come here, and yet you did it, man. So I appreciate it.
Oh, come on, man. This is how I do. You know, everybody's important.
Yeah.
You know, everybody's movement is important. Even if it's not important to me, it's important to them. And if I don't respect your movement, you shouldn't respect mine. So
you're big on respect.
Absolutely.
Like, that's one of the things, like, when I did my research, you know, one of the things that you said was, You just like want to respect everybody. You don't want no enemies.
No, I don't.
Where did that start?
I don't know. You know, my mom was always kind of like open. You know, like my house was the place everybody played basketball in my backyard, and we played football on the side of the street, and you know, we had food everybody could eat. You know, at our house, so it was kind of like an open society, you know what I'm saying, and a loving environment, even though, you know, sometimes it was chaotic as well, but I guess I got it, you know, from being around my mom with that kind of open openness, you know, the willing to accept other people, and sometimes even if you don't agree with, you know, their philosophies, you know, it was still okay to be friends.
Yeah, nah, that's real. That's one of the things I felt like the older generation, like, y'all are better at, because y'all could disagree to agree on certain issues.
Yeah, yeah.
Our generation, man, they be on some bullshit. You know, everybody.
Well, now they want to kill you if they don't like what you say. You know, I don't like what you say. I don't like what you wear. You know, I'm gonna kill you.
Yeah.
So definitely a different time.
Speaking of which, I saw you take a picture with Mike Bloomberg. Politics is mainly where that happens. So what's up with that?
Well, you know, it was interesting, and I caught a lot of slack behind it off my social media. And you know, I tell my people that you know, I don't work for nobody.
Yeah.
You know, I never had a job. So I don't really know what it's like to have to take orders from anybody.
That's right.
And I kind of make my own mind up. You know, I do my own study, my own analyzation. And I'll take other people's opinion, and I'll even chop it up with you about the situation, you know. But at the end of the day, I'm going to go with what I believe, even if I have to take the lick, you know. Okay, I was wrong.
Yeah.
Spank my ass, you know.
Accountability.
Accountability, you know. So I got a call, you know, from the mayor of Compton, and she was like, Bloomberg is going to be in town. Would you like to meet him? And you know, all I do is listen to the news. You know, I don't really listen to hip hop or the radio. You know, my station is always tuned to the news, because every now and then they'll drop a jewel that'll throw you out front.
That's what I'm getting right.
You know
there.
What I'm saying? I like to hear the people come on, the experts, and talk about, you know, just like the coronavirus. I've been really keeping up with that.
I'm going to go into that afterwards.
Okay.
They got something against us.
And she called me and she was like, Mike Bloomberg is going to be in Compton. I was like, Compton? This dude is worth $58 billion and he's going to be in Compton?
Yeah.
You know, some of our stars never come to Compton.
Yeah.
You know, I think the last time Dr. Dre was in Compton is when they were shooting straight out of Compton when the incident happened with Suge.
Yeah.
You know, that's how often they come to Compton.
And that's 2020, and that's probably 2013. No, 2014, maybe.
A
long time ago, though.
It was a while.
Yeah. So you got a billionaire coming.
So what I'm saying is that people don't come to Compton.
Yeah.
They don't come to L.A., South Central. We just don't see those guys. Here, Mike Bloomberg, he's in Compton, you know, he's walking the streets, you know, like the same guy that I listened to on the radio was talking about, oh, I'm gonna put money into the black community.
Yeah. Nah, that's
I wanna know, are you telling the truth?
Yeah.
Are you really gonna put money in South Central? And if you are, I'm the one that you should be going through.
Yeah.
You know, you should be talking to me about putting money into my community, because a lot of times they put money in, but they give it to the wrong people.
Yeah, you know, it's funny you say that. I've worked with people with the same mindset as you. Independent, be your own boss. We don't allow no Red Cross, no nothing in between.
Why should we?
Yeah.
When the people are saying that they want to do it, why shouldn't we go out and let them do it with us?
Yeah.
Somebody that the community trusts,
right.
Somebody who loves the community. I really love South Central.
Yeah.
You know, I love my people.
Yeah.
You know, I love all my followers on social media. You know,
yeah.
I guarantee you, you know, not one of them will ever tell you that they came up to me and told me that they follow me and I didn't, you know, give them a brother hug and,
yeah.
You know, we go eat dinner together.
Yeah.
You know, they go to the arenas with me,
because
I don't feel that it's big me, little you.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Nah, that's humble, man.
I feel that we all equal and we all deserve the same amount of respect.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, and I understood the frisking search. You know, can't nobody can really talk about it more than I can.
Yeah.
I got the scars in my face to prove. Police brutality. All this is from police brutality.
Yeah.
All this is all these scars. You know, nobody on the street do that.
Yeah.
Police did that while I was handcuffed. So when you're talking about police brutality, I know police brutality too well. Matter of fact, I'm going to court right now. I was sitting in my car about 4 months ago. Me and my son were sitting in the car. One of my friends that came in, and he got one of those tickets where they give you the hotel and the car. You know how you buy those tickets online, and you don't know where your hotel is.
Yeah. It's like the app, too, nowadays. You got
so, man, he got this hotel,
yeah.
And when we pulled up, I was like, wow. You know, this looked like one of them spots.
No, really?
Yeah, but it was, you know, I mean, it was. But anyway, he goes to check in. I'm parked in the loading zone, and the cop pulls in with his lights out. And I swear, it was people all over the place. And this cop pulled right up to my car.
Out of all the cars.
Out of all the cars, all the people walking.
Yeah.
He pulled right up to us. And he walked up to my window and he asked me for my ID. I gave my ID and my registration, insurance, everything, you know, because I'm straight. You know, I'm an auto dealer. And he was complaining about the car didn't have a plate on the front. So I said, oh, well, I'm a dealer and I don't have to have, I got a dealer plate on the back.
Yeah.
So my car don't have to have a plate on it, don't have to be registered or nothing.
Yeah.
Here's my WIC card for the auction. And he takes it and he runs it. And then his partner comes over to my son and he's like, you on probation or parole? And my son was like, yeah. And instantly everything changed. It was like, get out of the car. And I'm like, hold up.
Yeah.
Y'all got the right to demand him out, but you can't demand me out because I'm not on parole.
Yeah.
No, you get out of the car too, put his hand on his pistol. So I got out of the car, you know, because I know they will shoot us.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah.
We know incidents that people have done nothing but wearing a hoodie, and I did have on a hoodie.
Yeah.
You know, I keep my hoodie on.
Yeah, yeah.
So I got out the car, and after I got out the car, he asked me to sit on the ground. I'm like, I don't sit on the ground unless I want to sit on the ground. I don't want to sit on the ground tonight,
yeah.
You know. He said, if you don't sit on the ground, I'm going to take you to jail. And I said, well, you're going to have to take me to jail because you might take me down, but I ain't sitting down.
Yeah.
And when I said that, that's exactly what he did. He took me down.
So he hit you with like evading arrest, or
he charged me with obstruction. I'm charged right now. I'm going to court right now.
Yeah.
With obstructing an investigation and resisting arrest. So when you're talking about police brutality, I know it firsthand. I have my own task force, and these guys, 35 got suspended. I think 6 or 7 went to prison, you know, for civil rights violations, stealing money, planting drugs, lying on the witness stand, fabricating search warrants. So when you talk about corruption with police, I knew it firsthand. I testified against those cops, you know, that one night they planted drugs on me, you know, they planted drugs on my girlfriend, my mom, they planted a gun at my mom's daycare center. Just to take her license, just tactics to cause you financial heartache is what they were doing. So when you talk about police brutality. I know it firsthand. But I also understand that everybody deserves a second chance. You know, we've all made mistakes. You know, I'm no longer a crack dealer, and I know that selling crack was probably one of the worst things I ever did before in my life. And I've done quite a few things. You know, I'm not a saint. But selling crack may have been the worst thing that I ever did, and the least thing that I'm fond that I've done in my life, even though that gave me my notoriety, my fame, and all that. I know that so many other people suffered from me being able to drive a car with a nice paint job or have wheels on it or drive some, have some nice clothes or have a house. Somebody else, kid, probably went hungry because the mom has been to food stamps or whatever in order to facilitate this high. And I'm asking people to give me a second chance, you know. So if I want a second chance, shouldn't I allow other people to have a second chance?
For sure. And like that's in a way, like that's avoiding, because we all hypocrites in our own right. But it's like when you're mindful of it, I feel like self-awareness, I feel like that helps out a lot to where you just like, you know, where you just a second chance. For me, it's like being open to other people's opinions. It's like, you know, if I disagree with you, I don't have to, you know, you're like, I don't have to damn my feelings about that shit.
Yeah, you don't have to crucify them.
Yeah,
you know.
From it, like, oh, you got your point of view. That's that. Let it live.
Right.
So how did the meeting go with Mike Bloomberg?
Well, we just met briefly that day. I'm hoping that that the dialogue will continue.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know where it's gonna go, but at the end of the day, I think that we all should hold him accountable for his words, and we shouldn't just, you know, throw up our hands and say, oh no, I don't want no parts of that. Because one of the things that I like about what he said is that at least he's saying he's gonna do something for the black community.
Yeah, nah, for sure.
No other president has ever said, I'm gonna do this specifically for the black community.
Yeah.
Hasn't been done. Obama didn't do it.
Yeah.
Obama never said that he was gonna do anything for the black community.
Yeah.
And we love Obama.
Yeah.
You know, we put him in presidency, but he never once committed a certain thing to the black community.
Yeah.
And for Bloomberg to at least say it, maybe he won't do it. I'm not saying that he's gonna do it.
Yeah.
You know, I never said that.
Yeah.
But I'm saying at least he said that he wanted to do it.
Yeah.
And that he's going to do it. So with that, to me, is a step ahead of everybody else.
Nah, I can feel that then. So if people on social media, y'all need to chill in the comment section. I've seen the comments. Y'all need to chill. Take a break.
Well, you know what? And they have the right to voice their opinion.
True.
But what I would like for them to do is not only make an opinion, but also do the research to go with your opinion. Because now if you're basing your opinion on non-facts, then it's just an opinion. And opinions don't really mean much without the research and the facts to go behind it. So I would prefer for my people to do the research, and then on top of that, let's hold him accountable. Because he may win the presidency. You know, I think they say he spent already $170 million, more than everybody. And Trump can't keep up with him because, you know, he said Trump ain't a real billionaire.
Yeah, he's like, what was it? He's talking to him about the Twitter deal.
Yeah.
The Twitter exchange that they had. And, you know, they asked him and he said, you know, do you think it's fair? I'm paraphrasing. You know, do you think it's right to argue in public with, you know, for kids to see two billionaires arguing in public? And he went, who's the other billionaire?
Well, you know, he's not the only one that said Trump is not a billionaire.
Yeah,
you know, my guy that owns Virgin Records, I can't think of his name right now.
Richard Branson.
Richard Branson also said that he's not a billionaire and he makes billionaires look bad.
Yeah, speaking of billionaire status, as you move, you know, and I'm structuring it the right way. You were considered a billionaire at one point in time.
Yeah, some people say that.
Yeah. How was that, like, when you were, like, in the time period?
Well, you know what? When I was selling cocaine, I loved it. You know, I was willing to die for it, kill for it, but I was lost. You know what I'm saying? I wasn't in my right mind, because had I been in my right mind, I could have taken what I had and not only set myself up, but so many other people.
Were you like ever like counting like how much money was coming in? Because I know for me personally, like I set a number for me. At one point in my life, I want to make $50 million. I don't know how it's going to happen. I hope that it's tech. So, was there ever a number, like, growing up?
My number would change. You know, when I first started selling drugs, I wanted to make $5,000.
Really?
That was my goal.
And
I just wanted to put some wheels on my car, yeah. Get my car painted, and I was going to be good with that.
So, did you always have the entrepreneurial mindset?
I guess I always did, but I didn't really know what an entrepreneur was. You know, I grew up in a poor house, you know, single family, you know, only the moms. And my mom knew nothing about business. You know, she didn't know about structuring a business, how to start a business. But, you know, even when I was a kid, I used to organize car washes with all my friends. I would cut the grass. I used to hustle bottles, cans. So I guess I've always had the entrepreneur skill. But I never knew how to channel those energies into what I eventually learned how to channel it into.
Yeah. So now you're doing you're in the marijuana industry.
Yes, I'm going to be the king of marijuana. I plan on being the biggest marijuana dealer in the whole country. That's my goal. I don't have a number of how much money I want to make. I don't even care about the money.
Yeah.
I just want to be the biggest. I just want to dominate the industry.
Yeah.
I want my brand to be the biggest brand in the industry.
Yeah. And it's LA Kingpins, right?
Yeah, LA Kingpin.
Yeah. How long you had this going, you know? And what made you even jump into the industry?
It was a long story, man. I just got off parole. And I wasn't doing well financially.
Yeah.
I was getting eviction notices on my door because I was paying half my rent and couldn't pay the other half. And sometimes I'd be $200 short, and sometimes I'd be $700 short. And I just wasn't in the space that I wanted to be in, you know, financially.
Yeah.
And one of my guys came by, you know, to celebrate with me the day I got off parole. And a white guy out of Ohio named Matt, and he's a stoner. He's a real stoner.
Okay.
I'm talking about a real stoner. Yeah. When you see stoner, he's a real stoner. So he came by and he was like, "Man, I'm going to San Bernardino to the High Times event. You ought to ride with me. You all parole, come and celebrate, smoke a joint." And I was like, "Man, I ain't smoking no weed." And because I hadn't smoked weed since the early 80s, you know.
And so, hold on, what year is this that you get off parole?
I got off I don't even remember what year it was. Probably like, let me see, I did 6 years on paper, so it would have been 09, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14,
okay,
15 maybe, 14, 15.
Okay.
So, he talks me into going to the event with him. He's like, "Man, I bet you'll sell a lot of books out there."
Yeah.
And so I went and grabbed 6 boxes of books, like 200 books, and we headed out, man.
Yeah.
And just like he said, I didn't even get in the gate,
yeah.
And they started buying them books. "Man, Rick Ross, man, we love you.
Yeah.
Thank you for all you did for us, for your sacrifice." And basically they were saying that with me exposing the CIA's actions in the cocaine, also helped make marijuana legal in California. So they just showed me so much love, man. It was like this new environment that I never saw before.
Yeah.
I never saw people with like trash bags of marijuana, big jars of marijuana like this big, just sitting on the table in the open, and then the cops are walking by protecting it, and people are smoking weed, and man, they was giving me like, I was tripping, right, because I don't even know that I'm going, but then there's people here like, "Man, I made this popsicle for you, it's vegan.
Yeah.
I made this sucker for you, it's vegan. I made this candy bar for you, it's vegan."
Yeah.
And I was like, "Wow, this is the kind of love I'm going to get?"
Yeah.
So, they bought all the books, so I didn't have to carry no boxes outside. I had a big wad of money, and man, dudes was coming up with money, wads of money like this, like we used to have when we sold cocaine. And I was like, man, I want some of this.
I can feel that.
So when I went home that night, I called my brothers, and I was like, man, y'all didn't tell me about this, man. Because at that time, what I noticed, I had never even noticed that it was a marijuana industry. You know, because I was kind of like, you know, it's kind of like when your tunnel vision, and my vision was to get off parole because I had a PO from hell. This guy was trying to send me back for everything. So I know what I had done is I'd done just what I was supposed to do to get off parole. And I also kind of felt like, you know, getting into marijuana would be a stepping stone of me going back to selling cocaine. But then what I realized is that I had already committed to myself that I was never going to sell cocaine again, so I didn't have to worry about that. You know, that was already established. That's over with. Right. So no matter what happens, you're not going back. But then I was like, it's legal. Rick, it's legal, Rick. You can get a license. You're going to have a permit. You know, you get to ride around with the paperwork. So I jumped in, man. I started with $500. And I did pretty good. I got up to they stopped me on the highway one day. I was going up to the mountains to buy marijuana, and they stopped me. I had $105,000 in the car. The police took my money. But I started to do really, really well in the industry. I saw the similarities between the marijuana and my skills that I use in the cocaine business.
So if you had to give advice to people right now, like mindset wise, what would it be as far as like applying it to the industry?
Well, with any business that you go into, you want to be focused. You want to have tunnel vision. At least during the time that you're doing whatever it is that you're trying to do. You know, you want to be focused right into that. You don't want to, I mean, let's use boxing, for instance, because, you know, I'm working with, a matter of fact, we got a fighter fighting tonight. Saul Rodriguez is one of my guys. I've been working with Saul since he was 16. I went to a fight, and he was 16 years old. He came up to me, and he was like, man, you should be managing me. I'm going to be the champ. And I was like, this little boy, get out of here. And here I am now in Dallas. He's the main event tonight. But you have to really be focused on whatever it is you're going to do, because if you don't want to be the best, then you just want to be mediocre.
Right.
And if you're mediocre, you're going to get mediocre pay. But if you're great, you know, why? I just do so much studying. You know, I study like Michael Jordan. Why was Michael Jordan getting $45 million a year? And then they got another guy who's only getting $500,000.
Right.
Was this guy... was Michael that much better than this guy that he should get what?
45.
That's what, 100 times more money than this other guy. So what was the difference? Well, skill set, but Michael focused on what he was doing. This other guy probably was playing around, you know, last one to practice, first one to leave, you know, slacking on all of his workouts, you know, wouldn't do his shoot arounds like he's supposed to. And that's usually, you know, people say, oh, well, they get talent. Well, my teacher says that the talented guys are always first to practice and the last to leave. So maybe work ethic and talent goes together. You know what I'm saying? Maybe there's something that can't be separated. You know, because I hear people all the time arguing, you know, oh, well, he's just a natural. Well, somebody what I would call a natural is a guy who never picked up a ball before and comes on the court and totally dominates. I never saw that before.
Nah, this is fact. They talking about LeBron and how much he invests in his body. And, they say like millions he spend on his body, but you know the guys like that, they put that time in. You know, even like listening to you talk earlier, you do your research.
You have to do your research. I mean, without research and without knowledge,
and applying it.
you're going to suffer.
Yeah.
You know?
I had struggled with that for so long, man. It, like, literally, I'd be a big reader, but I wouldn't apply it.
Yeah, you got to apply it. You know, in one of my most favorite articles, LA Magazine, they did an article on me, and it's called Rick Ross is Dreaming.
Yeah.
You got to read that article one day. I was in prison with a life sentence, and the guy comes up and visits me.
Yeah.
And he's talking about me reading these books, this Get Rich. I really didn't have no option. I had a life sentence without the possibility of parole. They tell me I'm never going home again.
Yeah.
And I start reading these books, and he calls them the Get Rich Quick genre. You know, what the mind of a man can believe, the body can achieve.
Yeah.
And he said that I was testing out their plausibility. And you know, I didn't know what plausibility meant.
Yeah.
So I went and looked it up in the dictionary. And plausibility means that I was checking to see if they really worked. And that's what happens with us. We don't check the plausibility. We just take our opinion and run with it. I believe that everything that we do, everything that we hear, should be tested. One of my favorite books, Think and Grow Rich, he talks about having an open mind.
Yeah.
You know, can you open your mind up to accept new things? He asked me a question one day. I read the book like 25 times,
yeah,
too.
That, and then I know The Richest Man in Babylon.
It's another one of my favorites.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you're big into the Get Rich Quick book.
I don't really figure that. I don't even think they Get Rich Quick books,
because
they don't talk about that you're going to get rich quick overnight. You know,
it's really about the mindset.
The mindset.
Yeah.
The dedication, the sacrifice, the burning desire, all those things play a big part in becoming successful. And so often people think that when they see somebody like a Michael Bloomberg that he was lucky.
Yeah.
You know, now a Donald Trump, whose daddy and granddaddy was rich, is a different story. But that's why he's been jacking off all their money.
Yeah.
You know, they say he lost more money than anybody in the
bankrupt twice.
I think last year they say he lost $800 million or something of other people's money.
Yeah. See, that's crazy. And, you know, that's another thing, too, man. I hear a lot of guys preaching, and, like, I can't really speak on it because I haven't applied it yet. But, like, the whole use other people's money.
Oh, I love it.
You're hearing it?
Yeah, I love that.
Okay.
But I took it a step further.
Okay. Talk about it.
See, when I was in prison, that's what they talked about, using other people's money.
Okay.
So I was like, wow, what's more valuable than money? No.
What is it?
Their brain.
OG talk.
Go ahead.
Huh? That's OG
listen,
talk.
Listen to me.
I'm listening.
What's more valuable than their money? Their brain.
Yeah.
Why? Because their mind generated the money.
That's game.
So if you know what they know, you can generate what they generate. It's just like baking a cake. If I show you the recipe to bake a cake, all you got to do is follow that same recipe. You're going to get the exact same cake.
Yeah.
As long as you keep it in the oven just the same amount of time. Now, don't keep it in there 10 minutes longer because you might burn that thing.
Yeah.
Don't take it out early.
Yeah.
Don't put extra milk or eggs or whatever the ingredients, the flour. Put just like the ingredients say, you can get the exact same cake.
Yeah.
So what I said is, why not use their brain?
Yeah.
No, let them keep their money.
Yeah. So I'm pretty sure that you're good with networking then.
Oh, I love networking.
Yeah.
I'm a networking fool.
Which is why you're big on respect. So, hold on, yeah, come on, man. It's like, come on, drop that game. So, all right, when you're networking, what's like... the first thing, like, let's just say people skills.
Listen more than you speak.
Okay.
Because if you talking and they can't talk, and if they talking and you talking, you can't hear what they said.
Right. They say you can't transmit and receive.
So I'm big on listening.
Yeah.
You know, I like to do my talking too.
Yeah.
You know, but when I'm around people who are spitting game, I listen. I'm good at copying people.
Yeah.
You know, somebody say, don't be no copycat. But my man said, make sure you copying the right cat.
Yeah. I once heard Shaq say, like, this is at the time when I was doing music. He was like, whatever you do, do a remix. Like what you saw, throw your spin on there, but make it better.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Same scenario.
Yeah.
So, you know, when we copy somebody, copy the right cat. Because you're going to be copying somebody. Everything that we know, we learned from somebody.
Speaking of learning, you're an author. First off, let me tell you, I know that you couldn't read as a kid.
Yes, I didn't learn how to read until I was 28.
Wow. So how did you, what made you get into, like, reading?
Well, I was in prison, and they told me that I was never going home again. And there was some old cats, you know what I'm saying, that was jailhouse lawyers. And they was like, man, you count on your lawyer to get you out?
Yeah.
And I was like, yeah, I got a good lawyer, man. He went to Harvard University, top of his class, and I'm paying him well. He's like, man, that dude got kids. I was like, yeah. You think he care more about you than his kids? I was like, nah, I know better than that. He got a wife. Yeah, he got a wife, man. You think he cared more about you than his wife? I was like, nah. He got a practice? I said, yeah, he got his own law firm. You think he cared more about you than his law firm? I was like, nah, he ain't gonna risk his law firm for me. He got other clients too, don't he? Now, he might care more about you than his other clients, but he don't care more about you than all his other clients put together. I was like, are you right? They're like, so you think he wants you out of jail better than you should want yourself out of jail? And I was like, nah, you right. I better get on my studies. So I went to work, you know. Marcelli made me some cue cards so I could learn how to read. I got me a brand new dictionary, one of them nice, pretty ones, and I like to have it around. And everybody would come and, man, let me see your dictionary. And I was highlighting it, and first book I ever read was Malcolm X, and when I read Malcolm X's book, I saw that he couldn't read either. So then I felt kind of good, like, damn, Malcolm X, one of the baddest dudes that ever lived, and he couldn't read either. He taught himself how to read in jail. And then when I was reading the book, he talked about, if you lock us up, we're going to learn how to read and write. So I saw myself in Malcolm, you know. So he kind of like gave me courage to go forward, to go hard. And I saw that I could do what Malcolm did.
Yeah.
You know, and I just started. I just went to work, man. But that's how I started reading.
Okay. So then you start writing books. You're a legit author, man.
Yeah, man. It was the book came about because all the youngsters used to come to me and ask me for game. You know, they was going home. So, cause you know when you're in federal prison, you're gonna be in there with a guy who might be going home in 6 months.
Yeah.
And a guy with a life sentence might be in the same dorm. You know, might be living in the same space. So these youngsters used to come to me all the time, and they would be like, Rick, man, I never made $10,000 selling drugs. How was you able to make so much money? And I would just give them game, you know, like, look, man, I took all my money and reinvested it back into my sack.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't want a car.
Yeah.
You know, I wanted a bigger sack.
Yeah.
You know, I started working to get a pound. I started with an eighth. I had 125. My partner had 125. So we started with an eight, what we call the eight track.
Yeah.
And from the eight track, I wanted to get a seven. And from the seven, I wanted to get a half ounce. And then I wanted to get an ounce. And I just wanted to get bigger, 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 bigger. Right. And I kept pooling all my money. The only money that I would take out was money that I was eating off of.
Yeah.
And I told him that was really my secret to being successful. And later on, I learned that they call that compound interest. You know, where you're compounding your money back into the business. Then when I read Richest Man in Babylon, he said specifically that you're supposed to take that money out for yourself, you know, every time. Don't spend all your money on things that will be soon forgotten. I think is his correct words.
Okay.
You know, like you buy a pair of shoes, you wear them for a year, and they gone, and you throw them away, you forgot all about them. To take your money and buy things that you can remember. You know, things that's going to last, things that's going to be around, it's going to hold value. And that's basically what I did in the cocaine business, but unconsciously did it. So now I can consciously do those things because I know that these are the things that I should be doing. Hey, you know, I try to lace these dudes. You know, I spoke at the high school the other day, and a lot of the kids, they saw me on Vlad TV. So they was like, man, I saw you on Vlad. And I said, did you hear me when I told Vlad the only reason I talked to him is because y'all listened? Because if he wasn't teaching, he wasn't allowing me to teach y'all. Because really, I should have a reality show right now.
Yeah.
You know, they should.
I see you going casting.
I am. I'm starting one. But I should have been had it. Really, we should have documented my whole journey since I got out of prison. I mean, it was a hell of a journey. You know, Floyd Mayweather picked me up from the halfway house.
Really?
Yeah, so you're talking about it's been a journey that we could have got a lot of lessons from.
Yeah.
It's been a lot of lessons lost. And that's kind of like this book, The 21 Keys.
Yeah.
The 21 Keys is kind of like those journeys.
Yeah.
Cody wrote with me every day.
Yeah.
Sorry about that. Cody wrote with me every day, and he took notes,
yeah.
You know, of my journey. But I just wondering how much better it would have been if it would have been on film, you know. Because people love film more so than they like to read a book.
Visual learners.
But these books are definitely treasures. And I just shake my head that people are really slipping on these books because when I wrote these books, I was trying to let them into my head. You know, I wanted them to know my mindset. Like I told you before, will you take the money or the brain?
Yeah, that's the biggest gem that.
Well, you know, in The Richest Man in Babylon, he talks about it. He has a story where his father sends his son out to be a man, and he gives him two bags of gold, and he gives him some clay tablets. And when the son comes back, the son gives him back his two bags. No, he gave him back three bags of gold. And he said, for the clay tablets, I think I'm going to give you six bags of gold because this is how much more I value your wisdom over your money. So basically what this kid was telling his dad was that your wisdom was six times more valuable to me than your gold was. And it's so important that we learn that because sometimes only thing we're after is the money, the money, the money, the money, the money, the money. And I'm saying, get the wisdom, get the wisdom, get the wisdom. The money will come. I tease people sometimes. I was talking to somebody the other day, and I said, you know, when I go and do a deal, I had the money right here, and then I had that bat right here. So if you don't take that money, I'm going to put that bat on you. I'm working on some major marijuana deals right now, and I'm going to put this bat on them. If they don't take this money, I'm going to put that bat on them. So we have to be in a position of power. You know, so often we work from a position of weakness instead of a position of strength. And I want our people to become powerful and strong. And, you know, I hate yesterday, you know, when I spoke to the kids, I should have ended it with come and help me.
Okay.
I need help.
Yeah.
You know, will you help me? Will you come and be a part of this movement and show the world that we can do anything?
Yeah, nah, that's real. Yeah. So then, do you think down the road, do you think you ever do like an online master class in a way?
I want to do that.
Yeah.
I want to do an online master class. Or a TV show. Matter of fact, I'm talking to a network right now, Impact Network.
Okay.
I'm going to meet with the owner, and maybe he'll let me set something up like that. I have been trying I got all the way to the president of BET with the show too, where I was going to be taking kids that was about to go to jail, and the judge would give them one more chance and let them come and work with us, and I help them get their life back together. And BET dropped it at the last minute and said, oh, no, it's too serious.
Too positive. I like, yo, that's the one thing I don't understand. But then that's where we come in, we take over. Like you said, we do our own thing.
Yeah, we got to. Mm-hmm. We can't count on other people to look out for us.
Yeah.
You know, just like I couldn't count on my lawyer. My lawyer, when I found the issue that eventually got me out of prison, the lawyer who went to Harvard said I was wrong. If I would have listened to him, I would still be sitting in prison right now. Just luckily that I had enough confidence in myself and my reading ability and my understanding of the law,
yeah,
that I said, no, put it on the record. Because he didn't even want to put it on the record.
Yeah.
And if you don't put it on the record, you can't appeal it.
Really?
Man, I mean, you know, what y'all got to realize is when you hear me talk, you're hearing a guy with less than a second or third grade education going by the school system.
Yeah.
You know, if you went to my records, they would say that I was retarded.
Yeah.
And when you hear me talk right now, I know I don't sound retarded no more.
Oh man, you're like literally, you're the wisest guy I've met. Man, that's same forever. You know, other than that, it's my dad. You know, like this is not me just like talking.
So you ain't stroking me.
Bro, I'm mind blown right now. Like, I'm sitting there in shock and literally just like, man, it's a lot that you can learn. And like you said, like the brain, it's literally like, I want to be next to you, Mr. Ross. Like,
well, you know, our brain is our most valuable asset.
Yeah.
And so often that we forget how powerful the human brain is. I mean, the brain sends rocket ships out of space.
Yeah. And even then, like, we build the computers, and even like with AI, I'm pretty sure you're aware of it. With AI, like as much as people deem it as a danger to us, we can still outthink that.
Yeah.
We put our minds to it.
Absolutely.
You know, and so that's, I don't know, Mr. Ross, like, yo, you, man, you dropping some gems.
Well, you know, I just wanted to share, you know, some things with you. You know, you're a young brother, and I feel that my wisdom could also assist you one day in your journey.
Look, I got the book yesterday, and I'm going to apply this. You know, literally.
And you should. You should check out its plausibility.
Yeah, plausibility. Yes, sir.
You should check its plausibility to see,
yeah,
is he lying or what?
No.
I want to know. But you should want to know.
Yeah.
Is he lying?
Yeah.
Is he telling the truth?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so often though. And we take other people at face value.
Yeah.
You know, they tell us something, and we believe that shit.
Yeah.
And we support them.
Yeah. And that's only because we too lazy to, like, you know,
to do the research.
Yeah. Nah, that's crazy. And even then, so it's like, I don't know, man. Like, Mr. Ross, you keep coming with content. So, like, what's in it, like, in the near future? What other things do you got going on?
Well, you know, my main thing right now, the low-hanging fruit, is the marijuana industry.
Yeah.
I think I got the deal worked out last night with the company that's going to do the do.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? They going to take the cash.
Yeah.
So they don't feel it. They're not going to get the raft, but it's going to be a bunch of them that have to fill the raft.
Yeah.
I'm going to keep touring with my book.
Yeah. How many press media like companies have you went to over the past few days? Because I know your hustle is intense.
Man, I just left Oakland.
Yeah.
You know, I did about 8 or 9 in Oakland.
So, like, with your energy, do you do any coffee?
Mm-mm. No, I don't do coffee. I'm on vitamin D right now. I'm also studying with the brain surgeon right now. So, don't be surprised if you see me in the surgery room one day doing brain surgery.
Oh, no. No, that's dope, man.
Yeah, yeah. I'm putting together a thing right now. With one of the top brain surgeons in the world.
Yeah.
He also thinks that he's going to be the one to come up with the cure for, what's the name of this disease? Coronavirus?
Really?
Yeah, he thinks he's going to be the one.
Wow.
He says that he can kill anything.
Man, that's crazy. Speaking of the coronavirus, yesterday, man, I hop on Twitter and I see the CDC, a way to avoid getting the coronavirus. Guess what they want us to do?
What's that?
I'm not making this up. They want us to shave our beards. In order to avoid getting the coronavirus. This is something they literally tweeted.
What does a beard have to do with?
In my head, I go, is this overhyped? You know?
Yeah. Well, you know, matter of fact, we talked yesterday, me and the doc and one of my other partners was on the phone yesterday talking about it, and he said that the coronavirus is definitely a disease that nobody really knows about yet.
Really?
It has some components that they never saw, you know. He says it has like claws on it.
Okay.
Where it sticks to your body.
Okay.
It grabs you.
Yeah.
And it holds itself to you.
Yeah.
So it's definitely a disease that nobody really knows about. And he says it's going to probably be a pandemic.
Wow. Yeah, and I'm hearing that too. It's crazy. But I don't know, man. I'm just like, if anything, you got it. Like, it makes me more of a germaphobe. In a way.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, I'm catching myself washing my hands more than I usually do, and even like more showers. But then, so yeah, it seemed like you're getting this heavily into the medical field, if anything.
Yeah, I am. I mean, well, you know, the goal is to help the people.
Yeah.
You know, it's not really to make money. I mean, I want to make money. I need money to pay my bills.
Yeah.
But I'm pro to people first, you know. I wouldn't, if I came up with a vaccine, a doc come up with a vaccine and I had something to do with it, it wouldn't be where he would be gouging. You know, I wouldn't, definitely would not be happy with gouging the people.
Yeah.
You know, I would definitely want it to be distributed, you know, fairly and equally, you know. Yes. So, and I'm hoping that I'm the one that helps him put this facility together. He doesn't, right now, he has a vitamin D that he created that clears the mind from old times, how you pronounce it, autism,
yeah.
The boxers. He got in touch with me because he saw me working with boxers.
Yeah.
So he reached out to me.
Yeah.
He saw me with the boxers. So he reached out to me. He said, you know, I can help your boxers.
Yeah.
And I was like, what you mean? He said, you know how they be slurring and punch drunk and whatnot. He said, I can clear their head up. I can get all those black spots out their brain. And I was like, what? And so I jumped on a plane the next morning and went and met with him. And we sit down and he bought me lunch and we talked. And he told me about some of his concerns and some of the ways that this system has treated him.
Yeah.
You know, he's a black man, so he felt that the system hasn't treated him fairly.
Yeah.
You know, he's come up with things and they've taken them from him. And I mean, kind of like me, you know.
Yeah.
They took my name.
Yeah.
You know, they took my story.
Yeah.
You know, the TV show Snowfall, that's about my life.
Yeah.
Number one TV show on TV. I'm not getting a dime from it.
Yeah.
Not even a consultant credit.
Yeah. Speaking of which, like, the impact that you have had on culture, you watch these things happen. Do you care about it at all?
Kind of, you know. I mean, I feel flattered, you know, to have had such an impact on society. But now I want to have a positive. I want my grandkids to be able to say, yeah, my granddad, he sold cocaine for a little while. You know, just for a little while. But look at all the other stuff he did. When the coronavirus hit the world, he was one of the ones that helped stop it. You know what I'm saying? Could you imagine how my grandkids would feel if they was able to say that? You know, like, my granddad was a part of that. So those are the kind of things that I want to do right now. You know, those are the things that I want to be remembered for, you know. And you know, I know they're going to probably throw up the cocaine, you know. Oh, he sold drugs.
Yeah. That's the haters, though. They only going to focus on the negative.
Yeah.
Like, I'm looking at what you're doing right now, and I'm like, I'm just amazed because I'm like, as an OG, like, you literally, like, I know your work ethic. You probably put in 100 hours a week minimum.
Probably so, or maybe more.
Yeah. But, like, for me, man, I'm looking at things now because I'm like, I just want to increase my work ethic. And, you know, that's one of the things, like, you spoke on.
And you got to enjoy it. You know, when you enjoy it, then you don't want to, you don't want to end it.
Got you. That makes sense. Yeah.
You know, you want to just keep going. Like, this is it.
Yeah.
You know, this is my ultimate high.
It drives you in a way.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So what other things you got your hands on as well?
Oh, you know, I got my clothing line.
This is clean.
This is my clothing line.
Yeah.
Fill the material.
Hey, dude, that's hella nice.
Yeah. So I'm planning on bringing, like, top quality clothes. but for rock bottom prices. I mean, the same thing I did in the drug business. You know, I wanted to have the best cocaine I could get and sell it to them as cheap as I could sell it to them. So I'm doing that. I got the clothes going on. I still do my motivational speaking.
Where can people buy the clothes?
Oh, they can get it at my website, freeatrickyross.com. Also, you can get the book. Yeah. You can get the both the books.
Yeah.
You can get both the books there. I also do cars. I got a car lot.
I heard you say
I sell cars.
Yeah.
What else am I doing? Oh, the movie. I'm working on the movie right now. We've been wrestling with the script for about 3 years.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I want this story to be told the correct way.
Yeah.
I don't want no more snowfall bullshit out, you know, where they're glamorizing and making it look good and not giving people the facts.
Yeah.
I want kids to be able, when a kid read this book and he's thinking about getting into the drug business, he gonna know exactly what he's getting into.
Yeah.
He gonna know the ins and outs, what's gonna happen at the end of the rainbow.
Yeah.
You know, because a lot of times they think at the end of the rainbow is a rap record.
Yeah.
You know, with Universal or Def Jam, he's gonna sign you.
Yeah.
You know, so I want him to know.
Yeah.
You know, that it could be some handcuffs, some cufflinks.
Yeah.
You know, at the end of the rainbow for you.
Yeah.
So I'm doing that. What else am I doing? What else am I doing? I'm working on 2 reality shows. The boxing.
Yeah. How many hours of sleep do you get, man? You got...
I get about 4 most days. 4.
You like? So I'm assuming that you're a part of the marijuana industry. You obviously smoke, but then do you?
I eat.
You eat.
I don't eat no alcohol.
Yeah.
No alcohol. I never drunk. You know, every now and then I have an occasional drink, maybe twice a year. You know, I might drink some champagne, a little wine. But no, not a drinker.
Yeah.
You know, drinking killed too many of my uncles and cousins and so forth. So, no, I'm not a drinker at all. And the only vitamins I'm taking right now is vitamin D.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I'm a vegan, though. You know, I've been a vegan for 30 years. I found out I didn't need meat to live.
But then anybody come to you with that idea, like, hey, you should try this?
One of my friends, he made me a bet that I couldn't do it for 6 months.
$100. $100, really?
Yeah, he made me a $100 bet that I couldn't do it. I won the $100. I spent that $100. and when I went back to eat meat, I got sick.
Gotcha.
So
I might as well stay on the path.
Might as well stay where I'm at.
Yeah.
I'm getting everything I need. I don't feel any different.
Yeah.
And he gave me a book too called Do You Live to Eat or Eat to Live? And in that book, I saw that there was people that wanted me to eat meat who really didn't care about me.
Gotcha. And like that's the corporate. Yeah, that's crazy, man. So, do you think, like, cause by you being in health, do you ever think you would do a food product?
Oh, I definitely want to do food products.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, everything that they do, I want to have a part in it.
Because
we should have alternatives.
Yeah.
You know, we should have choices.
Yeah. And even like, you know, growing up, I grew up in Detroit. So growing up like in the hood, you just like, you don't know.
You don't know your choices.
Yeah.
If you don't know you have choices, then you don't have a choice.
Yeah.
And if you never exercise your choice, then you don't have a choice.
Yeah. Yeah, I hope y'all listening. He's giving it casually.
I try to, man. But we have to exercise our choices, you know. If you smoke cigarettes and you think that you could quit or you don't need cigarettes, then you have to try one day.
Yeah.
You know, and see if you can quit.
Nah, that's all one of my things now. I'm like, for me, it's drinking. I'm going to tap out, you know. My goal is to do literally... My birthday is May 9th, so the goal is just to like tap out, man. And by then, I don't want to.
You tapped out already?
Nah, yeah, I made up my mind.
Today?
Today, I made up my mind. Yes, sir. Yeah.
Why leave something for tomorrow that you could do today?
Hey, that's procrastination side.
You can't be a procrastinator. My man
in
The Richest Man in Babylon, he said, procrastination has killed so many men's dreams.
Yeah. Nah, seriously. And I can see it, man. And even then, like, even listening to you talk, it's like, I picture you a go-getter. Whatever you see, like, that interests you.
I go for it.
Yeah.
I don't wait.
Yeah.
Why wait?
Yeah.
Why wait till tomorrow?
Yeah. And so, like, what's the next big thing that you're, like, totally, like, because I know it's a big goal in mind.
Well, I mean, working with the doc is big.
Yeah.
You know, he's talking about helping people with old timers, with football players, with the black spots.
Yeah.
And then if he comes up with a cure for this coronavirus,
yeah.
I mean, that stuff is like, you really can't get no bigger than that.
Yeah, not
you know, but I wouldn't be surprised, you know, if people see me maybe on a basketball team or football team or something like that there. I could see those things. So maybe I'll buy Apple or